this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in the studio Port Townsend resident Harriet Cannon. Her work and writing has been in the area of multicultural relationships, multi-ethnic identity, and intercultural transitions. Her degrees include a Master of Counseling. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a licensed mental health counselor. She has 30 years' experience working as a counselor, consultant, and workshop presenter in the United States and internationally, helping people through the process of claiming a mixed cultural identity, a complex, evolving journey. As a consultant, Harriet uses her extensive knowledge, warmth, and humor to take people beyond the basics of multicultural relationships, individual, couple, and family identity, parenting multicultural and multi-ethnic children, reducing the stress of international transitions and acculturation. She has worked in continuing education for psychotherapists, counselors, social workers, marriage and family therapists, and teachers. She is co-author of the highly acclaimed book, Mixed Blessings, A Guide to Multicultural and Multi-Ethnic Relationships. Welcome to our program, Harriet.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so excited to have you here, especially during these times when people of many backgrounds are worried about their safety and worried about where we go from here after our 2016 election. So I'm wondering if you can tell us first how you ventured into this area of study, and then we'll hear about how you use it today and maybe what you can encourage in us about an understanding of multicultural situations and relationships and ethics and how to live in a more positive direction.
Okay, thank you. I was born into a multicultural family where you can't tell the multiculturalness by looking at my face. Both sides of my family were Euro-Americans, but they came from different religious practices, different parts of the U.S., different social classes. And so I learned going back and forth between my extended families to be what I needed to be wherever I was, but never fully belonged anywhere. Then I grew up, got interested in social science and studied that, became a therapist. And when I was 40, my husband and I and our two teenage children moved to South America, where I worked part-time for the State Department and part-time for a Chilean business of psychotherapists. So what my learning there, my greatest learning, was my tremendous affinity for immigrant families, because we were one. So we lived there for several years, had to learn a new language quickly. There's no press one if you want to hear English on the telephone. You don't get that at the bank. And my children immediately immersed into Spanish and became fluent in 6 or 8 months. My husband took a couple of years, as did I, to be really good fluent speakers. So I know what it's like to watch your children embrace a new culture and become Chilean while you're an American. And to weave that space back and forth of trying to keep your traditions and language at home while watching it dissipate. When we moved back to the U.S., once again, my difference didn't show on my face. And it was the time in the 1990s of diversity trainings were blossoming. But I was not welcomed in because I was a Euro-American. And the assumption was I didn't know what I was talking about. So that was a most interesting experience. I ended up using my energy to do what my profession was, and that is work with immigrant families, people in mixed cultural families, people with differences that showed and differences that didn't. Here I am today talking to you about
right,
it.
Sitting in the KPTC studio. Well, along the way, you have written many articles as well that have appeared in publications such as the International Family Therapy Association's Journal, the Washington Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. You've written Multicultural Living multiple times and a column on multicultural parenting for them. You've written for the Society for International Education, for the Seattle Times, for Seattle's Child, and even for the Boeing News. You're getting word out there about the things you've learned. So somewhere along the line, you were accepted into this group of people who study multiculturalism and help us all understand both people who don't feel multicultural, mm-hmm. although by now we all should,
right?
And people who definitely do have borders and boundaries that they're negotiating all the time. Mm-hmm. So Where did that happen, getting accepted and beginning to be able to delve into the work?
Well, by doing my own work personally and not feeling understood when I came home and really struggling with being bicultural and bilingual and having no outlet for that, having no way to transition back and trying to figure my own way through it and coming to a different level of understanding that the issues in the United States are not just about race. They're about culture and social class and spiritual practice. And for lots of reasons, the diversity in the United States has been focused on race only because we have so many problems to solve in that area. And the other types of misunderstandings across culture got minimized. And in my experience, what I found in working with individuals and couples and families and institutions and work teams is that unless you address it all, you miss most of what you're trying to do because we aren't all the same. We aren't all just Euro-American or Black or Asian or American Indian. You know, we are diverse within our identity groups.
I hope that you've come prepared to read to us a little bit from your book, Mixed Blessings, so that we can get the flavor of the premise of your book and of your work.
I am. I brought something. So I'm going to tell you, I'm not a great person for reading aloud, but I'll make a good effort here. I'd like to read a little bit from our book, Mixed Blessings, and I say our because I have a co-author, is divided into three parts. The first part explains some basic concepts about culture and identity and understanding and in-group, out-groupness. The second part, which is the major part, is 12 stories of 12 different couples with all different kinds of mixed race, mixed ethnic, social class differences, and how they solve the problems that they have in their relationship. And the third part of the book is some exercises that people can do at home. So the purpose of our book was written as a self-help book. The decision to write it was after many years working with multicultural people and multi-ethnic people, they kept saying, well, where's a book? Isn't there something practical I can take home and read? Isn't there something we can do? I don't want to be in your therapy room discussing this forever. And I agreed I didn't want them in there either all the time, forever and ever and ever. The whole idea of, you know, helping people to help themselves as opposed to being the one that's always there to direct them. So I decided with my colleague Rhoda Berlin, and we wrote the book. It was a blessing, a passion, a wonderful experience, but I will read to you from part of the chapter on ethnocentrism. We make a rational assumption about someone's behavior based on what we would or not do in the same circumstances, ignoring the otherness of the other. And here's an example that starts the chapter of a couple that had a problem, an ethnocentric problem. Valerie and Tim's first Christmas together as a married couple was approaching. Their previous Christmases had been spent apart because as college students, each had returned to his or her parents' home for winter break. Valerie, a second-generation Korean-American, expected Tim to be excited about the prospect of being in sunny California over the winter holiday. Tim, Pennsylvania Dutch, expected Valerie to be excited about experiencing her first white Christmas. When they finally got around to talking about it, each was perplexed and more than a little resentful that their partner wasn't willing to spend the holiday with the in-laws. Each had assumed the other would want to share and adopt a treasured holiday experience, a piece of their partner's heritage, tradition, and cultural identity. Each was surprised and hurt by the other's reluctance to give up their family practice. It was their first big fight, and it stung. The holidays were supposed to bring them closer together, not highlight the differences. Ethnocentrism is not racism. An ethnocentric perspective means we consider we know what to be best. It's rooting for the New York Yankees, not the Texas Rangers. Ethnocentrism is a natural human phenomenon with key evolutionary purposes. It's an integral part of the development of our cultural identities. When the human species was young, survival depended on knowing where and with whom we belonged. It was vital to be able to quickly gauge the level of risk exposed by strangers. We still identify and categorize other people. It helps us to identify our in-group, our tribe, and create a safety zone. Think of sayings we have along these lines. birds of a feather flock together. If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Think about the last time you asked a stranger for the time. How did you choose someone to approach? You probably looked for someone wearing a watch or a cell phone. Did you also consider his or her dress, demeanor, gender, age, ethnicity? It's a natural, automatic, usually unconscious process. We judge appearances to minimize our risk of harm and maximize our success. Today's political landscape attempts to be bias-free. We like to think that physical appearance has little to do with how we relate to people. Recent brain research shows this isn't true. Human beings have an evolutionary need to identify with groups. Part of the process of recognizing our in-group is governed by the older part of the brain, the amygdala. Anyone who survived the teen years knows exactly what in-groups and out-groups are. We all want to belong. We each have to develop our own definition of what it means and how it affects our behavior. Luckily, we're not solely dependent on the more primitive part of our brain. Our frontal cortex enables us to have critical thinking. If we react negatively to a stranger based on appearances, it's up to us to remind ourselves to override our fight or flight instincts. So here's a little tidbit going forward with Tim and Valerie. Tim and Valerie were not the only ones in their family who had to redefine belonging. In addition to the differences between their East and West Coast cultures, they were the first multi-ethnic couple in either family. This forced their family members to redefine their tribes, since there was now a member who looked like he or she didn't belong.
Thank you. Now you're leaving us with a cliffhanger.
Did they make it?
Did they?
Yes.
Can you give us one key hint of how they made it?
It was in really talking about how blending a culture and going forth with a concern to having children would each of the worries on the part of each of their families, and to a certain extent when they talked about it later themselves, would they lose their cultural identity by blending it? And the fears around that, which speak to a lot of the fears of what's going on in the world today, is if you give up something, will it be lost forever? Are you no longer you fully? And do you belong to the tribe? And will your children belong to the tribe?
You are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender on KPTZ 91.9, Port Townsend. Today, Sheila is talking to Harriet Cannon, co-author of the timely book Mixed Blessings, A Guide to Multicultural and Multi-Ethnic Relationships.
This is a very timely series of questions people have because of what's happening in our supposed melting pot culture, even what a melting pot is in terms of ethnic identities and loss. So I want to ask you, what do you see as our most important tasks now as a melting pot culture, because our leadership appears to be denigrating the very attributes of a diverse society?
I think it's a crisis and it's an opportunity to move to another level of really talking about fear of otherness. And I think concurrently with the fear of otherness is the concern about not enoughness. There have been tremendous changes in our culture, and I'm talking about just U.S. culture now, and who lives here in the last 30 or 40 years. Last year, more minority babies were born in the U.S., babies of color, than traditional Euro-American babies. And going back to Tim and Valerie, this is exactly that feeling of who are we and where are we going to go from here. And some of it is based on appearance. Will my children look like me? Will my grandchildren look like me? And some of it is, what are they going to have for Thanksgiving dinner? And I think there's a very deep emotional feeling about belongingness. And when we lived in more larger family groups, as many cultures still do, people had many family members that had their back. And so there was an agreement of if one person got in a problem, then the rest of the family would go and take care of them. Now we live so often as individuals, and there is sort of a deep longing and a fear that people have of who's going to take care of me if I'm somehow cast onto the outside, if I'm the minority person, if something happens where people cast aspersions on how I look or how I dress or what I wear or my gender orientation, will I die? And I think it goes back to something as basic as that. And people have a feeling or a temptation to then want to, there's the old fight or flight amygdala kicks in. And what we're seeing now, I think, on both sides, unfortunately, whether you are of a Republican or a Democratic persuasion or a liberal or a conservative persuasion, of trying to make a case of how your way is better. And rather than, I think, the opportunity that we have, and I hope that everybody will take it, is to go and find somebody who doesn't agree with you and sit down with them and really talk deeply about not just why they think women shouldn't be allowed to have insurance pay for their abortion. I mean, that's a really emotional one. But what are you afraid of if they do? You know, what's happening to your belief system? Do you think you will not be able to have it if you don't get your way? I think that's also true when it comes to racial profiling. I think one of the things that is a big mistake is that the government or the police or the school says, oh, people, you don't really have anything to worry about. We're going to take care of you. And the truth is that isn't the truth. There's a lot of dangerous things out there. And we can't keep everybody safe. And the best way to keep the most people safe that we can is to try and make alliances with people that we don't know who are different from us, instead of gathering what we think of as our tribe and going to attack the other side. And it scares me a lot.
Yes.
That's where we're headed right now.
I know you're prepared to talk about something unusual these days, at least in Port Townsend, which is about fear mongering from not the right, but the left. You told me that before we sat down. So this is probably a good time to address that since you said the word scared.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. So we're talking about this right before Thanksgiving. I went to a Thanksgiving service at the Linwood Unity Church. And the talk was given by Ted Falcon, who is one of the three amigos that you may sometimes hear on NPR. Mm. It's a rabbi, that's Ted, an imam, a Sufi, that's Jamal, and a Presbyterian minister. It used to be Rodney Romney, who was a Baptist minister, but he's retired. So Ted has these gatherings, and he said something yesterday that was similar to what I was saying. He said, we need to go and talk to people. And he was talking to a Jewish congregation, so there was a lot of fear in the room. And he said, we all need to go out and talk to, go to Eastern Washington, go to a church there, get a focus group going, sit down with people and say, what is it that you're afraid of? What's most concerning you that you will lose when you have a neighbor that's a lesbian couple that's getting married? What's scaring you? And listen to them deeply. And then talk to them about how can we embrace each other in some ways. We don't have to agree, but how can we make this the best it can be? And so he went on, he gave this brilliant talk, and at the very end of it, a woman raised her hand and said, could we have everybody's email, please, because I've got a demonstration I want to get going in mind. And it was like, whoosh, off it went. This whole beautiful talk was just completely disappeared.
So she might have said, could we all have a moment to turn to one another?
And think about ideas of who do you know that's in a very conservative mode that maybe we could have a coffee with them. No, she didn't do that. She went right back to the fear because that's the tribe. That's the let me gather my forces and turn all of our shields out.
Right. But on the other hand, when you have thousands of people demonstrating somewhere, there's a voice. Doesn't have to be a fear necessarily. I don't know what her demonstration would have been about.
No.
I see your point that it overshadows our ability to one-on-one talk. And when you talk about asking people what they fear they'll have to give up, or you said, do they fear that they won't be able to believe what they believe? Mm-hmm. That's a really serious problem because people who engage in learning about another person do sort of evolve into new thinking. Mm-hmm. And anytime you grow, even from writing, I mean, you grew writing this book, I'm sure. I know every time I write a poem, I've changed. Mm-hmm. Many, many people don't want to encounter that. They don't want to. That's why in my world, poetry is difficult because people think it's too hard. It's not too hard. It's just that you're a different person after you understand a poem. In your world, families have come because it matters to them to negotiate these differences. Mm-hmm. So how do we, in a world where many, many people don't even want to go there, let alone sit down and talk, they don't want the next step, which is for some of their beliefs to change. What do we do?
That's a difficult one, and it's complex because it depends on the person and the situation and who you're talking to. So some people are afraid because they've been traumatized. The people that, I guess, in my experience, I've had the most success with is, you know, racism is learned. You're not born to it. And either you're taught at home or you're taught at school, or you're taught at some group, but it can be unlearned with a conversation if you are a healthy person and someone sits down with you and doesn't immediately start to blame you. And I think that's my biggest concern, is that when we do a demonstration with a blaming, often profane, violent reaction. That's why Martin Luther King's still my hero. That ante has gone up over time. And sometimes it's because people haven't felt they're heard. And sometimes it's because when the race card is played, or the gender card is played, or the gay and lesbian card is played, it's assumed that all people of a certain race or gender are the same, and they're not. Regardless of our ethnicity and our cultural heritage or however we want to define it, we still have differences. Some of us are intellectual, some of us aren't, some of us are writers, some of us are ditch diggers, some of us are criminals, some of us have been abused unfairly. And to assume that you can talk blanket about prejudice and racism and with making assumptions that everybody is the same. And I think that's where we get in trouble with the blaming. All white people do this. All black people do this. All evangelicals are like this. And that gets embedded in a belief system of another tribe or group. One-on-one is good. Small groups are good. But the biggest word is, why are you so afraid to talk to me? What's most concerning your heart that I won't understand you and may not agree?
So it's that start local. Mm-hmm. Eat local, shop local, talk local. But talk across boundaries.
Across boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have more to read from your book?
Actually, I have a couple of the stories that are dear to my heart. I'll read you a couple of examples from maybe of different couples from the beginning. The real stories are too long to read in a setting like this.
Well, we'll have to get the book and read
it. You'll have to get the book and read it.
From reading it.
Yeah. So I guess in saying that, here's one of the things that many people don't understand about the difference between culture and race and people misunderstanding each other. And I guess it's a big function for immigrant families, because over time, people do lose their culture and change. Just as you were saying, as a writer, as a poet, you change every time you create a new baby. This is an example from a first and third generation immigrant couple. And so it goes like this. So it's just very brief. It says, Eric is a third generation American Chinese. Ling is a Chinese citizen who has lived in the United States for 8 years. They started out as colleagues and friends at work. Their relationship became serious. And when they announced their engagement, their families were thrilled. Ling says, we told my parents in Singapore and Eric's parents in San Francisco. They were happy to discover our family roots are from the same region of China. Everyone thought it was a fortuitous sign for a happy marriage. Ling had thought she was acculturated, but in marrying an American Chinese, she discovered that, in fact, she's Chinese and Eric's American. She says, we feel misunderstood. We're ethnically similar and culturally diverse.
So that's the kind of hidden things that you were talking about.
That's the kind of hidden things that I'm talking about. And sometimes people in that situation, couples, families, intergenerational families, it's one of the things that we see, I think, with people being radicalized, is when there's a cutoff between a parent and their children and the culture to which they're adhering, and then sometimes a backlash because parents do what they think is the best thing, and that is to pack their children off to the homeland, and, you know, it all blows up. And that's the worst-case scenario. Yeah. There's also a lot of easier ones. And then here's another one of cultural identity, appearance, and loss that is very poignant. And I think this is something else that's a great fear. We talk about fear and belonging and how do you define a multi-ethnic, multicultural tribe. So this one is when it's Jennifer, Anders, and Hannah. When Jennifer Chu married Anders Sondheim in 1982, they hyphenated their last names, content their daughter, Hannah, would carry both cultural surname legacies into the world. Last year, Hannah married a Spaniard, Javier Garcia de Costa. Hannah couldn't imagine introducing herself as Hannah Chushan Sondheim, Garcia de Costa. There's the inclusiveness with a straight face. So she took Javier's surname. Hannah also told her mother, Jennifer, that a 21st century woman doesn't lose her identity by taking her husband's surname. Next month, Hannah and Javier are expecting their first child. Jennifer's thrilled to be a grandmother, but also sad, remarking, "There were no sons in my generation, so no one is left to carry my family's surname. I also wonder if my grandbaby will look anything like me."
Mm, it is poignant. I have to tell you that we could talk much, much more, and I hope we do again sometime soon. I hope everyone will read your book, Mixed Blessings, A Guide to Multicultural and Multi-Ethnic Relationships. It will help us a lot during this time, especially having heard you talk about how person to person we might be able to turn things around and give us some courage to really listen and to really get at the root of so much of the dissension. Mm-hmm. So I especially want to thank you for coming to the show during these difficult times. I'm going to sit down and read these stories. I have stories of my own, of course, and if we think about it, we all do. We all have stories about how our backgrounds and our neighbors and our children's address what we most fear, what we most question, what we're most surprised about, and how to live with all that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.